This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The 2008 election is over, mostly. Sarah Palin makes the media rounds. She and the other Republican governors gather in Miami, and she's not the only presidential possible on hand. It's Wednesday, and time once again for our weekly visit with the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
The 2008 election is over, and you didn't think Ken Rudin's term would expire, did you? On Wednesday, NPR's political editor joins us to talk about all the latest political news from Washington to Wasilla, the transition, the runoffs and the recounts, then the contest for party chairmanships. Later in the program, how the internet has changed the campaign game and Google flu. But first, it's the political junkie. Ken Rudin joins us in boring old Studio 3A, and as always, starts us off with a trivia question.
I'm using the applause from the museum.
It's that Citizen Kane applause.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, Neil, Howard Dean, who's leaving the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee. He, of course, as you know, in 2004, he also ran for president. There were two DNC chairs before that who also ran for president. Who were they?
If you think you know, the former DNC chairman who also ran for president of the United States, it could be chairwomen, I suppose. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. They ran for the Democratic nomination, right?
The Democratic nomination for president, right.
Just wanted to check with that. We mentioned Howard Dean. He's, of course, going to be with us tomorrow on the program. You also mentioned he's leaving as the DNC chair. This is normal. Traditional, the new president.
New president picked, right. And actually, for the Democrats controlling the White House, the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee is not going to have the same visibility that it would had John McCain or the Republicans retained the White House. And Howard Dean said from the beginning that he wouldn't stay around for another term. There's a lot of mixed reviews about how he did. He has a famous feud with Rahm Emanuel, who's now, of course, the incoming White House Chief of Staff. But Howard Dean from the beginning believed in this 50-state strategy that he said that Democratic resources should be put in all the 50 states to make that, you know, as opposed to just a 14-state strategy that John Kerry and Al Gore basically ran on in 2004-2000. So Rahm Emanuel said, no, we should be focusing only on the seats we need to pick up. And they, you know, there was a difference of opinion, but I think both proved to be correct.
And the Democrats obviously roared to triumph in unusual places. So Howard Dean essentially vindicated.
2006
yes.
and 2008. Right.
And 2008. And, of course, Ken Rudin's electoral map, not so predictable.
I was more hesitant in giving Barack Obama some states. I did not see, for example, North Carolina, Florida, Indiana, and Ohio. But on the Senate and House, I did extremely well.
Well, three, however, remaining to be decided in the United States Senate.
Yeah, and actually the biggest story has turned out to be Minnesota, because as Catherine Harris was for the Democrats, Secretary of State of Florida during that tortured recount in 2000 in the presidential race, the Democratic Secretary of State in Minnesota, Mark Ritchie, has been accused of doing everything he can to make Al Franken, the next senator from Minnesota, against Norm Coleman. They say that there's a bunch of votes are suddenly appearing out of nowhere, and they're all for Al Franken. And so all the suspicions that the Democrats had about Catherine Harris are now being done by Republicans, Ritchie. But again, it's a 206 vote difference with Norm Coleman leading. We still the recount is probably still going to go into December.
Despite the seven votes against him by a Washington, D.C. jury on felony counts in Alaska, it looks like the incumbent may have survived.
Well, we don't know that yet. There will be a lot of counts today. Right now, it's about 3,200 votes with Ted Stevens leading, Mark Begich, the Democratic mayor of Anchorage. But there are about between 80 and 90,000 votes that have not been counted yet. Many of them voted early, and according to numbers shown so far, many of the early voters voted for Begich. So Democrats have not ruled out winning this seat. Again, it's about 3,200 votes right now, with about 90,000 votes still to be counted.
And those, at least, are being argued out in court and in various political offices and headquarters, election headquarters. Nevertheless, the poor people of Georgia have to live with another campaign.
It doesn't end. This is a Saxby Chambliss Texas. Now, he had about 100,000 votes more than Jim Martin, the Democratic nominee. But in Georgia, you need 50% plus one. Saxby Chambliss only got 49.8%. So they will be a December 2nd runoff. John McCain, you remember him. He was the guy who ran for president. He will be campaigning for Saxby Chambliss tomorrow in Georgia. About at least 100 or so Obama people are coming in from other states to work on Jim Martin. No word yet on whether Obama will campaign for him. I suspect he won't. The last time this happened in Georgia was in 92 when a newly elected president, Bill Clinton, campaigned for White Fowler, who didn't get 50%, went to a runoff and lost to a Republican in the runoff, Paul Coverdale. So obviously, December 2nd in Georgia, that will be ground zero for the campaigns. The campaigns never end, and that's why we need to keep the political junkie on the show.
Every week on this program, every Wednesday.
I think so.
There are still a couple of House seats undecided, too, and there may be another one. We're just getting word from the Federal Appeals Court in Richmond, which upholds the indictment of Representative Jefferson of Louisiana, clearing the way for his trial. This, of course, the gentleman who was found with cash in his freezer.
Right, and they had a Democratic runoff on November 4th, and Jefferson, the initial primary had about, I think, like 15 or 8 or whatever African-American candidates and one non-black, and that one non-black was a Latino woman, and Jefferson went into the November 4th runoff. Jefferson won that. It's an overwhelmingly African-American district. There's a runoff against a Republican candidate next month, which Jefferson should win big. But again, if he's convicted, he may have trouble staying in the House, just like if Ted Stevens wins re-election to a seventh full term. He may have trouble staying in the Senate. Three-quarters of the Senate would be needed to evict him, but there may be tremendous pressure on him to leave.
In the meantime, there may be tremendous pressure on Democrat, or I guess independent, Joe Lieberman to leave the Democratic caucus.
Well, there's going to be a meeting of the Senate Democrats on November 18th. Joe Lieberman obviously did everything he can to elect a Republican, John McCain, president, his friend, and said some pretty nasty things about Barack Obama, that he wasn't ready to lead the country. He spoke at the Republican convention. There are a lot of liberal blogs, but also a lot of Democratic senators who say that Lieberman should, one, be stripped of his Homeland Security Committee and even drummed out of the Democratic caucus for being a turncoat, you know, all the things that have been said about him. Now, Barack Obama, well, first of all, Bill Clinton weighed in this and he said, look, don't, you know, don't anger Joe Lieberman. The election is over. The hard feelings are over. We have 57 seats in the Senate. If Joe Lieberman wanted to, he could have become a Republican after the 2006 elections and kept the Senate in Republican hands by turning over, by becoming a Republican. So give him a break. I mean, you know, he may have been misguided, but we'll show him the right way. But there's tremendous pressure on Harry Reid and other Democrats to strip Lieberman of his committee chairmanship.
In the meantime, we have a trivia question out there. Other than Howard Dean, who were the two previous chairs of the DNC to also run for president of the United States? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's start with Ian. And Ian's with us from Copenhagen?
That's correct, Neil.
Copenhagen, wow. Denmark?
Not Copenhagen, Tennessee.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us who you think it is?
Well, one of them I'm thinking is Chris Dodd, who, of course, ran, I know, for president in 2008, but I'm not sure if he's run before then. But he was, I believe he was chairman sometime in the 90s.
I think he may have been chairman of the Senate.
No, he was a general chairman of the Democratic Party, which means there are three Democrats. I forgot about Chris Dodd. I need somebody from Copenhagen to tell me, but exactly right. Chris Dodd, during the Bill Clinton presidency early, was the general chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and he did, of course, run for president in 2008.
Okay, and who's the other one you have, Ian?
And my other one is Henry Jackson, who, of course, was our seventh president. No, that's not actually.
And does he have the scoop there, Kenrod?
Oh, very nice, very nice. Henry Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington, was the Democratic National Committee chairman in 1960, 1961, when John Kennedy was elected. And later in 1972 and 76, Scoop Jackson did run for the Democratic nomination and lost. So he got two of the three. There's one more.
There's one more.
Wow, Chris Dodd, I like that. There's one more.
now. Three as of now. We don't know.
So. Well, Ian, you do get the no prize today, and if somebody calls in with the third surprise candidate,
I'd be happy to share it. I'd be happy to share it.
If somebody calls from Copenhagen, Tennessee, we'll see.
We'll see if that works. Or maybe they just use Copenhagen. Anyway, Ian, thanks very much for the call. Congratulations.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that's interesting.
I like that.
Yeah, all the Republican governors are meeting in Miami as of today. I think it's a beauty day today at the I'm not kidding, at the Republican National
Well,
Republican
they have a lot of Republican governors who either are thinking about running for president or wish they were picked as running mate in 2008, whatever. But you have Bobby Jindal, you have Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, who was my prediction for vice president. You have Charlie Crist, who has a national role, Haley Barbour, and Sarah Palin, who you may not remember. She was the Republican nominee for vice president in 2008, and she will be speaking tomorrow. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot of attention. A lot of people saying 2012. I can't believe that with all the problems with the Republican Party, not only they should be talking about not only November 2008, but January 2009, when Barack Obama and an increased Democratic majorities take over in Congress. And yet there's so much attention, probably mostly by the media, though, talking about 2012. And I think that's really irresponsible of us, because I think what you want to focus on is what the Republican Party can do to come back as a legitimate opposition party.
Let's see if we get one more trivia answer on the call. This is Joe, and Joe's calling us from far-off Chicago, Illinois.
The happiest city in the U.S. right now.
I bet it is.
It's actually three. It's Chris Dodd, Scoop Jackson, and Fred Harris, who is a liberal senator from Oklahoma.
Ding, 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 ding,
Fred
ding,
Fred Harris
ding, ding.
Is correct. Senator from Oklahoma. He ran for president in 1976. And very few people know this, but Fred Harris's birthday is November 13th. My birthday.
No, you're kidding.
It's November 13th.
Yes, tomorrow?
Yeah, tomorrow, yes.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes.
Yes, and?
Fred Harris, yeah,
and the
Fred Harris
come out.
Is the correct.
That's right. And as a birthday present, and thanks, congratulations, Joe, and thanks very much for the call. As a birthday present, I understand The Political Junkie is going to turn into a blog.
Starting December 1st, we don't know if it'll be a separate standalone column, but Political Junkie will be not once a week, it'll be every day.
Oh, gosh.
I know, America needs this.
Can you wait? Can you possibly? What about the column? Is that going to continue too?
I think so, or it may be subsumed into it, but it'll be there wherever you look. It'll be there, whether you want to see it or not.
Well, in the meantime, Ken Rudin's latest Political Junkie column, which explains why Karl Rove's Mac was more accurate than his, is on the website at npr.org. Stay with us. We're talking with Ken Rudin, our Political Junkie. Up next, forget the economy. It's the Internet, stupid. We'll take a closer look at how the net has changed politics in 2008. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie every Wednesday. You can read his column, soon his blog, and download his podcast at npr.org. And Ken is hardly the only one who's figured out how to use the Internet to reach out to people. So have politicians, as we've noticed. In this election, candidates used it to recruit volunteers and new voters and to raise record amounts of cash. And it immortalized clip after clip, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Katie Couric interviewing Sarah Palin, and Hillary Clinton moved to tears. In a new article published on Real Clear Politics, Mike McCurry, the former press secretary for President Clinton, and Mark McKinnon, who advised President George W. Bush and Senator John McCain on media strategy, argue that the Internet has brought a new business model to politics and to democracy. So how did the Internet change this election for you? How might it change governance and democracy? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk at npr.org. Mike McCurry and Mark McKinnon are both political consultants now. Mike McCurry joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program.
Great to be with you.
And Mark McKinnon joins us from the studios of our member station in Austin, Texas, KUT. Good to have you as board as well.
Greetings.
And Mike McCurry, you say it's the Internet, stupid.
It sure is. This is the first national campaign in which the Internet dominated the way in which candidates reached out, got their message to voters, in a sense, almost bypassed some of the conventional ways in which we ran campaigns in the 20th century based around the mainstream media, the television ads that we see way too many of. This was an election in which the candidates went straight to the people and communicated their message and used this grassroots. Amazing. Obama, I think, had by the end 10 million people registered, and he was communicating with them directly and getting them to go out into their neighborhoods to deliver his message. That's a brand new way of communicating in politics.
And Mark McKinnon, we learned something subsequent to the elections, which makes it even more interesting. According to Newsweek magazine, somebody, maybe a foreign power, hacked the websites of both the Obama and the McCain campaigns, apparently trying to learn information about their positions that might come in handy when one of them gets elected.
Well, yeah, that's true, and it's a great concern. And we've been talking at Arts and Labs about net pollution, and that's a great example of it. You know, Joe Trippi, who was responsible for Howard Dean's internet revolution, said that that they were the Wright brothers, and the Obama campaign and this campaign was Apollo 11. And I think that's really true. But when you're Apollo 11, you better be careful about who's looking at you, and you better have security protections and the sort of things that we need to have an affordable, safe, reliable, and legal internet.
That's the
one thing,
thing
that I would just add to Mike, what Mike said. the amazing thing about the internet in this election, the real application that it has is that it's a harness. It harnesses the energy, and the Obama campaign had extraordinary energy. Campaigns in the past have had energy, but they didn't have a way to harness it, and that was that's the beauty of the internet. It gives people tools so that they can become part of the campaign, so that they can do something, so that they can actively participate, so that it becomes a two-way interaction where they feel like they have, that they've been empowered by the campaign, they can actually do something and be part of it.
One of the things that Mark and I have been working on are trying to get companies working together to deal with the problem of what we call net pollution. There's just way too much spam and malware and viruses, things that are going to interrupt people's ability to use this important tool for citizenship. And I think we can start a collaborative effort now to work on that problem and make sure it remains a very open, vibrant resource for candidates and for those who want to advocate their point of view.
And I think if we turn to you again, Mark McKinnon, we can all understand how it revolutionized fundraising, looking at the amazing amounts of money that Barack Obama in particular raised on the internet. But it also revolutionized how the campaign ground war occurred on Election Day. The Obama campaign was using something they called Project Houdini, where people with smartphones were interviewing voters as they came into the polls online. And they would say, well, cross Joe Smith off. He's now standing online. We don't have to worry about him coming down to vote later today.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Let me just read you a quick graph here from a Weber-Shandwick memo about the internet and the election. It says, MyBarackObama.com allowed supporters to create 27,000 groups over the course of the campaign, which resulted in 50,000 campaign events in the last 3 weeks of the campaign for a grand total of 200,000 events. This organizing infrastructure now allowed them to contact 13.3 million individual voters through 20,000 neighborhood team leaders, which, according to the Obama campaign, resulted in 1.9 million new voters. So that's an illustration of the power.
The amazing thing about this is it worked both ways. They had this incredible grassroots organization that was spreading the message locally through their local groups, but then they also had the ability to go top-down, too, because they could send things out from the headquarters in Chicago and communicate a unified message around the country. So a really extraordinary ability to kind of take your message and get it almost direct into everyone's home.
We're asking listeners to call in today to tell us how the internet changed their election experience this time around, how it might change democracy and governance. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. David joins us. David calling from the Lakes region of New Hampshire. David?
Yeah.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thanks. Hey, normally, I live in New Hampshire and normally get really involved with the elections and primaries and stuff and stay really attached, but I was so busy with family obligations and job and all of those things that the great thing about the internet this time was I was able to log into, you know, all different news sources and stay on top of what was happening, you know, at 2 in the morning or 5 in the morning or whatever. I didn't have to be listening to the radio or watching TV.
Well, we're very upset about not listening to the radio. And by the way, the other person logged in at 5 in the morning, that was Ken Rudin.
Yeah, you guys, I tell you, Ken Rudin and you are really impressive guys. I've been listening to you for a long time, and you're really good. The nice thing was that I could really, tie in and, you know, if something came up or I heard a little snippet in the morning on the radio, I could then go in at 9 or 10 at night and log on and start reading about it, and I'm normally really involved, this time I just couldn't be. So the internet's really made it less time specific, which has been great for me.
That's the great thing. 46% of Americans use the internet to get political information in this election, and it's an amazing repository for people just like this caller. And it also allows the campaigns to provide really rich content. You know, before we were hostage to the 30-second television commercials, and it was difficult for people to get substantive information, and now they can get whatever they want, and campaigns have a real obligation and responsibility to make sure that
I totally agree.
Go ahead, David.
I totally agree. You can go on, log on to any of the candidates' sites and read what's going on. You get the latest daily news. You can even hear what their response is to certain, testy questions or whatever that has shown up in the news, and find out whether it's just fluff or something real. And that was really great to be able to just sort of still feel like I had my finger on the pulse, but not necessarily be, in the same time scale as everybody else.
David, thanks very much, and we appreciate you being on our time scale today.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Ken?
You know, Mike, sitting here, in the past, like Ronald Reagan, if he wanted to reach beyond Congress, go past Congress, he would use television. But Barack Obama, if it's an unpopular measure or anything he wants to push through, he can just press a button and reach millions of people without having to even use television.
Well, it used to be you would go bypass the engines of what we would call the national media, the mainstream media, the large networks, the big daily newspapers on the East Coast, and go directly out to those local media markets. But you're right. In effect, now you can do that going direct via the Internet. The other thing that was impressive to me about the election result, the younger a voter was, the more likely they were an Internet-dependent consumer of news, because we all know that kids 18 to 24 are not picking up newspapers and reading them. They're still listening to radio.
Of course they are.
They are so dependent on the Internet. And if you look at the breakout of the vote, the younger the cohort of voters, the more likely they were to be Obama voters. I think under age 40, Obama got something like 67% of the vote. So it's really us old fogies, the baby boomers, that are still reading our newspapers and getting our hands ink stained, that are not with the program. And I think this will be a permanent feature of our politics, Ken, the ability of a president and a White House to really deliver the message directly to the people.
Can I add a footnote to that?
Go ahead, Mark.
The one difference during Reagan's time was that he could talk through television, but television didn't talk back. And now, of course, Obama's got 10 million supporters, and they're going to talk back to him. And I think that there's real opportunity, but there's real danger there, too, because, his supporters, he's going to have to make some unpopular decisions. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens when those supporters disagree with some policy things that he decides that he's got to do for the good of the country. And, for example, the whole idea that he might keep on Robert Gates as defense secretary right now, I think the net roots are already rising up, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
On the other hand, let me inject a degree of skepticism. One way you can measure a campaign's interest in certain forms of media is the money they spend on it, and both campaigns spent a whole heck of a lot of money on television and radio advertising, Mark McCartney.
Well, there's no doubt that that's true. Now, Obama had lots of money to throw at just about anything that moved.
But that last big splurge was a 30-minute TV ad.
And that was, again, direct communication. But I think when we look back and see where the proportion of money spent, did it go to the traditional form of political communications, the 30-second spots, or did more of it go proportionally to Internet-based advertising? Did it go to some of the new techniques that I think both sides used in this campaign? I think we'll see a real increase, and I'll bet that is a trajectory that won't change. We'll see less and less spent on a kind of traditional television.
I think there's a really diminishing return on standard broadcast television. The interesting thing is that the Obama campaign had 15 million hours of watched video on YouTube, which if you translated that into broadcast television would have been about $46 million worth of advertising.
Let's get Kate on the line. Kate with us from Chicago.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, please.
One of the things I think that really helped the Internet help with this campaign was being able to connect people through chat forums and chat rooms. Because I live in Chicago, which is very, Obama-friendly, but I was able to speak with voters in Ohio and Indiana and Florida and get a sense of what other people who supported Obama in those swing states, it made me feel like there was that we had a cohesive mm-hmm. group of people. Like, I couldn't just say, okay, Florida's not going to vote for Obama. So that inspired me to go out and work for the Obama campaign, saying, okay, there are people in Indiana that will vote for Obama, so I will go and make sure that happens.
That's a great example.
Yeah,
really great example. The other thing that the Obama, and maybe you were part of this too, that they created email groups. You could create your own email group in whatever sort of locality you are, and they created 16,000 of those that translated into 6,639 local Obama groups. So you could sort of mobilize and have your own grassroots group of email friends that make you an activist on your own.
Exactly. I'm a member of a mother's chat forum called Punky Moms, and it was really great to be on there, and we discuss politics all the time. So I'm getting the perspective from New York, from California, from Ohio, from Missouri, and uh-huh. encouraging each other to go out and campaign for Obama.
Mm. That's great.
Kate, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
We're talking with Mike McCurry, the former presidential spokesman, and Mark McKinnon, who is the vice chairman of Public Strategies Incorporated, former senator advisor to Senator John McCain, and to former chief media advisor to President George W. Bush, about the way the Internet has changed, well, not only political campaigning, but may change democracy and governance. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Mark, let me ask you, Ken asked a minute ago how President Obama may be able to use the Internet to go over the heads of Congress and the media filters. On the other hand, those net roots that we talk about, they can come back at him if they get exercised and if they get mobilized. It's going to be interesting to see how the White House, this new White House and this new Internet savvy White House responds to a prairie fire, if one develops, amongst its supporters.
Well, you know, exactly. The Internet is the ultimate democratization of democracy, and it's, you know, putting power in the hands of people. But, you know, that can cut both ways. And I'll be really interested to see how President-elect Obama deals with that and how the Netroots folks respond when something doesn't go their way and they rise up. And it'll be a challenge for the president, I believe.
One change that I think we definitely will see in how it affects governance is the concept of public information is going to become more expansive. I think a White House, when I left the White House in 1998, we had a website. I think the only thing on it were transcripts of my briefings that were pretty dull.
Brilliant.
but now the power of the Internet just radically transforms the whole concept of White House communication. So I think President Obama and his White House staff will probably take advantage of that and find new ways and new techniques using this technology to communicate the work of government. I think that'll be very, very positive. They've pledged transparency. The Internet certainly makes that possible.
Yeah, I think it'll be fascinating to see what they do at the White House. I think there's all sorts of opportunity. I know they're already talking about sort of a whole, you know, technology dedicated staff, and you know, not that there isn't one now, but I think they're going to. You know, I noticed that in the campaign they had 95 dedicated campaign workers, on their internet sector. And I think back to the Bush campaign in 2000, I think there were about five.
And we keep mentioning the Netroots were associated with the left wing of the Democratic Party. There's nothing to keep the other side from organizing on the web either. But anyway, Ken.
Well, that's exactly what I was just going to ask Mark right now. I mean, talk radio for the longest time was thought to be run by conservatives, or at least conservatives had better use of it, understood it better than the left. And then the Netroots came out and certainly seemed to control that kind of communications. What's keeping – why have not conservatives has the right or the conservatives not adapted to that kind of use as the left has?
Well, there's nothing like being in the desert for a while to get you inspired to find water. And I think that looking at the results of this election, Republicans are starting to organize. And there's already incipient efforts that we're seeing online. And they're going to get smarter and faster. And I think that they'll – we'll see some pretty aggressive efforts here over the next couple of years.
Let's see if we get one more caller on the line. This is Cody. Cody with us from San Francisco.
Yes, how are you?
Go ahead, please.
One quick point is that we often talk about, you know, the degree that we have some awe, in fact, for the Obama infrastructure on the Internet, how he was able to reach out to people and how he could get his supporters to talk to each other and to the Internet. But something that gets lost, I think, is the content itself was really important and that they knew their audience. They knew how to send things that the supporters would receive and then not just look at, but forward, and it would become viral that way. It would be a music video. It would be a discussion, a policy from the candidate, a campaign update from the campaign staff. And it was interesting. It was well done. It was showing other supporters doing things that you could yourself do. And you would send that to your friend, and they would send it to their friend. And that was one of the really powerful aspects. So I think a different candidate could have the same infrastructure in place and not be as successful, because content really does matter.
And that included everything from Obama Girl to Will I Am. And neither one of those people actually worked for the campaign. That was stuff they did on their own.
That was the fascinating thing, was that it really allowed people to be creative and to self-publish material and to be a part of a debate and not have some overlord back at his campaign headquarters putting a thumb on them. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the Internet. So, by the way, one of the things that Mark and I are working on now in this organization we have, Arts and Labs, to preserve that freedom of speech aspect to the Internet, to make it a place where people can actually come and have a debate and make sure that they're not, you know, sent off because of some of the what we call pollution on the net to things that are a little less wholesome. Because, there is a dark side to some of this and a danger, and we have to be careful to preserve this as a tool of democracy that works for everybody.
Mike McCurry and Mark McKinnon collaborated on the piece The Internet Brings a New Business Model to Politics and Democracy, which you can see at realclearpolitics.com. We thank them both for their time. They joined us, Mike McCurry here in 3A, and Mark McKinnon at the studios of Station KUT in Austin, Texas. Ken Rudin was also with us here in 3A. He'll be back next week, never fear, with another edition of The Political Junkie. Coming up next, using the web to track flu. It's the talk of the nation.